The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Okay, so we've made it to the third week in this three-week series, and if you weren't at the other ones or only one of the other ones or whatever, that's totally fine. This is a series on balancing our practice, and we've looked at a couple different dimensions of that, like in how we engage with the teachings. Do we engage with kind of faith and just surrender to them, or do we engage with inquiry and probing them and trying them out and applying our analysis to them? And then last week we looked at the dimensions of, basically putting in effort and cultivation of things and compared to letting go and just allowing practice to unfold. And so this week we're going to take on cushion practice compared to in the world practice, which is very much a dimension that seems to be of interest in the West. You'll see as I'm describing things that this is less of a relevant dimension. It's not as called out in the suttas, but you can put that lens on the suttas, and we'll do that. I notice that people often say in the West, how can I bring my cushion practice into daily life? This is a very common question, a very common way that people think about it. They've got their cushion practice and they've got their life, and sometimes they'll even say, I've been sitting for 2 or 3 years, but I still snap at my boss, or I still, get impatient with my kids, and how do I bring the calm that I feel on the cushion more into the rest of my life? So I don't know that the Buddhist teachings ever say there is such a distinction. So I think it's interesting that we automatically separate them in our mind. The teachings of the Eightfold Path describe a way of life that one undertakes if one follows the Buddhist path, and it leads toward liberation. But to practice deeply any of the folds of the path, the other ones have to be in place too. I don't think it's possible to just do meditation, for example, nor is it possible to just, if you want liberation, nor is it possible just to behave ethically and practice in the world. It's a system. It kind of works together. But we'll talk about how that unfolds differently for different people. It's definitely not like everybody does the same combination of those or should. So definitely in the suttas, the Buddha has a lot to say about how practice touches our whole life. There are certainly examples of that all through. And so we're going to talk about that first. I want to focus on the discourses. And then, because this is a question that's framed more from a Western point of view, I'm going to come back and talk a little bit more about the cushion in the world, offering reflections on how this has to do with the balance of wisdom and compassion, which is not as explicit in the discourses, but I think it can be linked. So that's the aim. Don't check me on it too carefully. No, I'm kidding. Okay, so in the suttas, let's start with that, because that's our focus in this series, is to really look at what are the written teachings saying. In the suttas, there is a distinction. It's important for this question. There's a distinction between teachings for lay people and teachings for monastics. Lay people tend not to receive teachings on sitting practice, probably. I'm going to put a caveat on that in a moment. But here, now, in the modern world, in both in Asia and in the West, there are lay people who have sufficient free time and interest to be dedicated meditators. So you have this group of people who are doing this. They're both in Asia and in the West. And so we're going to look, that means it's relevant to look at the teachings both for lay people and for monastics, because we kind of cross over into the monastic teaching if we're a dedicated lay practitioner. Let me just add a little caveat that there are suttas that are clearly addressed to lay people, like the Buddha is speaking with a lay person. That's the setup that's given. And then there are suttas where he's speaking to monks, and he says, you know, bhikkhus, blah, blah, blah. And sometimes those ones, it's clear that he really is speaking just to monks. Like it'll say, you know, the Buddha was residing in the Jetta's Grove with a large group of monks, and one evening they all were talking. And so you get the sense, okay, this is something that was delivered just to the monastic community. But there are other situations where it's not as clear what the context was. And in those cases, if he says just bhikkhus, it's worth noting that there is a kind of a tradition that if you're going to name somebody to address the talk to, you name the highest person who's there. And so that would be the monks. So if there were monks and nuns and lay people there, he would still say bhikkhus in addressing the teachings. So sometimes there may have been cases where he was giving a public discourse or something, and there were some monks there and some lay people there. And so we don't know in the teachings that the lay people weren't receiving some teachings relevant to sitting practice and so forth. But I think generally we can say that the monks got more of that. And it wasn't so clear that lay people, at least common lay people in the Buddha's time, were serious meditators. That was more for the ascetics who were outside of society. Okay, so starting then with the teachings that are primarily for lay people, these teachings are mostly, quote-unquote, in-the-world teachings, and they're mostly about ethics and what is sometimes called merit-making, but that's not intended to be, I hope that doesn't sound dismissive. Merit-making is beautiful. It's generosity and ethical practice and metta-practice, you know, the cultivation of good, wholesome qualities that are beneficial and that, you know, make the heart happy and more likely to if you believe in rebirth, it means it will lead to a good rebirth in a heavenly realm. So in these teachings, in these in-the-world, off-the-cushion kind of teachings, one way to practice, a common way that the Buddha prescribed, was through association and imitation. These are my words. So for example, in AN 854, the Buddha talks about four qualities to look for and emulate in a friend. And these are faith, sattā, virtue, sīla, generosity, chaga, and wisdom, panya. You may have heard generosity as dāna, of course, but chaga is said to be the intention in the heart behind giving. It's similar to the intention to renounce. And that's what we're actually cultivating when we give, is that tendency in the heart to want to respond and give. So there's a quote from this that says, "What is good friendship? Herein, in whatsoever village or market town a householder dwells, he associates, converses, engages in discussion with householders or householders' sons or daughters, whether young and highly cultured or old and highly cultured, full of faith, full of virtue, full of generosity, full of wisdom. He acts in accordance with the faith of the faithful, with the virtue of the virtuous, with the generosity of the generous, and with the wisdom of the wise. This is called good friendship." So it's pretty straightforward. You know, it says find good people, be around them, and try to act like them when they're acting well. I think we all have people in our life who exemplify certain good qualities. They don't have to be Buddhist, like our wise grandmother or the neighbor that we know we can always trust, something like that. And so the Buddha encourages us to use our discernment to notice who in our lives has such wholesome qualities, to associate frequently with them, and to consciously emulate their good qualities. I'm reminded that once I had a friend who was very kind to animals, and her worldly work was around protecting animals in various ways, and she knew a lot about animals and their habitats. And it was so interesting because whenever I was with her, I would see more animals. It was like that was just kind of what was in the air, and I could feel an appreciation and a connection with them that I might not feel as deeply on my own just because I was with her. It was kind of cool. Actually, I was riding a boat with her one time, and these dolphins came up to the side of the boat. It was like, wow. And I don't know if that would have happened if it was just me. Or maybe I wouldn't have seen them. I'm projecting, of course, but it was clear over time that this was true for her. So through this friend of mine, I felt more kind of interconnected, and I discerned that that was a good quality in myself to develop. So I think through her, I began to see within myself an untapped capacity for interconnection. It's not like I didn't have it and she had it and I could get it when I was with her. That's not exactly what the Buddha was saying. He was saying more, I think, that we all have these potentials, we all have these qualities, and associating with people who are actually manifesting them helps them to come forth in us more. That, I think, is the skillful way through this otherwise what could be comparative thinking, right? If it says you should associate with people who are faithful and wise and generous and virtuous, you might start thinking, well, I don't have this, or I don't have as much of this as her, so I better go hang out with her. That's not that healthy of a way to think, is always judging how much of something I have and whether somebody else has more. So I think this notion that we all have it, but it just has to be drawn out or resonant in some way and then growing, is a kind of a skillful way through that comparative thinking.
But how do you balance that with accepting who you are in that moment?
Well, Suzuki Roshi said, you're perfect just as you are, and you could use a little improvement. So something like that. So somehow, without disparaging ourselves, we have to also notice that there are ways in which we could be doing more than we are. It is a balance. You're right. I like that you used that word. I think we can sort of trust our heart in this regard, and just, we don't have to evaluate, go around with a little matrix, who has more of this? She gets a 10 on this one and an 8 on this one. I think it's more like just hang out with the people who make you feel lighter and clearer and happier, and it'll work. So this is kind of what the Buddha talked about. There are many other examples as in the world practice. It's get yourself in a good situation, develop these good qualities in yourself, and try to live a good life. And that is plenty, by the way. We know that that's not so easy, especially if you're, a busy merchant in ancient India or something where life is a lot more contingent, and maybe, I don't know if it is actually compared to now, but I think this is plenty for people to take on. It's just the development of even those four qualities, not to mention metta and some other ones. But in the West, I'll just throw in a little comparison that we tend to think of in the world or off the Christian practice as something like compassionate action. People want to protect the earth or join political parties or do social protests or participate in diversity education. Really beautiful things that are helpful for society as well as, of course, for our individual development. And I have to say that these are not explicitly mentioned in the suttas. However, we can... Although, I'll put in the caveat that there is a phrase that one should be responsive to needs and be charitable. These are often said about lay people. So I think being responsive to needs may somewhat go in that category. You see something that isn't as good as it could be and you respond in some way, or you see a person who's suffering and respond in some way. But it's not so explicit. It doesn't say you should go and join One Earth Sangha and participate, which is a great organization, by the way, and participate in helping to educate the world about climate change and a viable response to it that's not based in fear and anger and so forth that we do. This probably was just not a concept in the pre-democratic world. This wasn't a society where people were out protesting in the streets. It didn't make sense. There wasn't representative government. There wasn't a sense that individuals could change society in the same way. So I'll talk about this a little more later when I'm talking about more the Western version of this. But it's just worth noticing that we have to be more creative to find examples from the discourses that point in this direction, and we're kind of inventing something new in the West as we're doing these kinds of things. So the Buddhist teachings for lay people tend not to mention formal meditation. As I said, it's not clear if there were sometimes lay people in the audience. But I think overall it's not clear that many lay people were serious meditators at the time of the Buddha. But there are instances, interestingly, even in teachings for lay people, of mentioning wisdom in the form of seeing arising and passing. So he doesn't. It's not like all of the formal teachings that the monks get are not at all given to lay people. He does talk about that. And so, for example, there's a character named Mahanama, who is a lay person. And he's, I think, some kind of a government official. He had a tough life, actually, being a magistrate of some kind. There's a number of suttas about him, actually. And in one of them, SN 5537, Mahanama first talks about a lay follower. Well, he asks who is a lay follower, and the Buddha says, oh, one who has taken refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And then the rest of the sutta is about being accomplished in virtue, faith, generosity, and wisdom. Sound familiar? Those were the same four from the first sutta that we read. So this is a set that's often given to lay people. And then, just to point out more specifically what this means, Mahanama says, oh, in what way, Venerable Sir, is a lay follower accomplished in wisdom? And the Buddha says, here, Mahanama, a lay follower is wise. He possesses wisdom directed to arising and passing away, which is noble and penetrative, leading to the complete destruction of suffering. In that way, a lay follower is accomplished in wisdom. Well, that is exactly what he would say to a monk. So, you know, he says, accomplished in... he possesses wisdom directed to arising and passing away, which is noble and penetrative. That's code for, you know, sitting in meditation and watching arising and passing, which is understanding anicca, which is said a number of times in the suttas to be able to lead all the way to complete liberation. And he says, leading to the complete destruction of suffering. So it acknowledges in this sutta that even a lay follower can be on the path to liberation, can be a noble follower. So I don't want to say that lay people there's a split, like lay people were taught about merit-making and monks were taught about liberation. Not true. This sutta shows that that's not quite true. But on average, there was, you know, more in lay people getting those more basic teachings. So let me move on then and talk about how the Buddha addressed teachings to monastics. So for monastics, the Buddha did offer much more often, in fact almost exclusively, a path that leads all the way to liberation. You know, if you signed on with the Buddha, that's what you were doing. And so he would it's not just a path of meditation. So I might have set it up so it sounds like lay people don't meditate and they get the merit-making practices, and monastics meditate and they get all the meditation instructions and the liberative teachings. I also want to break that up from the other side. I broke it up for the lay people with Mahanama. It's not actually true that the Buddha didn't teach anything about off-the-cushion practice for monastics, not at all, because he had people who had given their whole life to practice. They had gotten, you know, stepped away from their lay life and put on the robes, and they did other things during the day. They ate, they slept, they worked. So he had teachings for all of that. He had a very integrated path for the monastics, the Eightfold Path, or their other models. I'm going to talk about some other models, actually. So in a sense, this is more what we model off of in the West. You know, we have, of course, we're not monastics. We haven't, you know, we haven't put on the robes and, you know, eat our one meal per day, most of us. But we do want teachings on meditation and teachings on how to live and how to eat and how to speak with people and how to work. And he told all that to the monastics. So we just have to interpret them for our lives, you know, working at a job instead of working on building the monastery or maintaining it. So it's also true that the dedicated lay practitioners in Asia also study the suttas directed at monastics. So we're going to look at this a little bit more carefully. What did the Buddha teach to monastics, which we might take on as dedicated lay practitioners here? There's a lovely teaching that he refers to by a name called the gradual training. And this is the sense that it takes a while to get our whole life in alignment. You don't just like put on the robe. Well, some people do, of course, put on the robes and immediately get in line, like Sariputta and stuff. But for most, it was like us, you know. It's like it's kind of a long process, and it takes a while to get everything aligned. It can be a little unintegrated at first. And so I want to talk about this gradual training, because it's pretty interesting how it unfolds. So in particular, just as an overall teaching, the Buddha says, I do not say that final knowledge is achieved all at once. On the contrary, final knowledge is achieved by gradual training, by gradual practice, by gradual progress. Yeah? So he acknowledges right there that it's going to be a while. And so then he talks about, there's a couple different templates where he talks about what this gradual training can look like. And I'm going to go through them because they're kind of interesting. One is a little bit more of a focus on behavior and how we're acting. And the other one is a little bit more of a focus on view and how we're thinking and relating to the world and intending. And both of those, I think, have to come in, because the Eightfold Path includes the wisdom part, the behavior part, and the meditation part. But these gradual trainings just have a slightly different focus. So the first template, if you will, or map — the map is not the territory, as you know, but one map for understanding what he meant by a gradual training — is it goes like this. You don't have to remember all these steps, but I'm just going to read them through. Training in ethical conduct, restraint at the sense doors, moderation in eating, devotion to wakefulness, mindfulness in daily activities, and meditation, which is either jhana practice or the four foundations of mindfulness leading to awakening. So let's go over that again, right? Training in ethical conduct. You don't start. You start by cleaning up your act. And I think we get that, right? It's not that easy to sit down on the cushion if you're raping and pillaging and all that. I mean, I know we're not doing that literally, but there's a sense that when you start practice, you have to kind of get your speech and your actions in alignment with basic virtues, basic ethical conduct. And he says, this is the same thing I do with monks. When they join me, I first give them training in this. Then, restraint at the sense doors. So that means cutting down in the areas where you're doing so much excess that it's actually causing suffering. You know, if your habit is to, you know, it's hard to do too much in terms of eating as a monk. But, you know, if you eat all the desserts that people give you instead of having a balanced meal, or, you know, you talk too much, or you lie compulsively, or you tend to steal the other monk's razors. You know, it's like, you got to get that down. Just restraining. Staring at things, and wanting to listen to things, and looking at women's bodies, and whatever else might affect a young monk. Okay, so then the third is moderation in eating. So this is learning to eat the right amount. Devotion to wakefulness, that one's actually about not sleeping so much. Mm-hmm. And it's for people — for monks, it was sleeping 4 hours a night. Of course, we don't do that as lay people. It wouldn't make sense for the level of activity we're doing. But it means being wise about sleep. So learning to sleep well, not drugging yourself to sleep and then oversleeping, and you know, kind of getting that part a little bit in line. Mindfulness in daily activities. So then that's very specific. He talks about knowing when you're extending your arm, knowing when you're bringing it back, knowing when you're walking or sitting or standing or lying down. knowing when you're walking, knowing when you're coming, when you're going, when you're speaking, when you're silent, when you're urinating, when you're defecating, all of that, just mindfulness in everything. And at that point, he says, meditation. Now, it's not that a monk wouldn't have been meditating up to that point if he had to go through all those steps. Of course, they did their daily practice with everyone else, but he kind of doesn't emphasize the meditation until all this other stuff has happened. There's a lot that goes on before one even sits down to meditate seriously. So it is not at all that you ordain and then instantly it's like, okay, great, now you're going to do the jhana training, now you're on retreat permanently. There was a lot of stuff about just getting your actions and speech and behavior in line and being able to have a balanced life, and then you can sit. So I think that's pretty interesting, right? Is that there's a lot that happens before you meditate. And then we'll also mention another template for this gradual training, one that focuses more on view and the mind and the heart. And so this one starts with confidence in a teacher. So deciding that you're going to listen to somebody, visiting that teacher and paying respect, giving ear, so listening to what they have to say, hearing the Dhamma, memorizing, examining the meaning, so you don't blindly believe it, but you examine the meaning, gaining a reflective acceptance of what you've heard. Then comes zeal, applying will, scrutinizing, striving, and realizing liberation. It says realizing the supreme truth in the text. But so this is an interesting one also, in that it starts with, it's a lot about your attitude and your belief. Not belief like what you're believing in, but you know, your approach, your framework, and your engagement with the teachings. So, but it starts with faith in a teacher or confidence in a teacher. So at some point you have to decide this is relevant, this is important. And then you hear the Dharma. So the Buddha is pretty clear that at some point you have to hear the Four Noble Truths, so you're not going to get completely, you're not going to be able to get completely there to understand that the whole point is to end suffering, not to end pain or not to end unpleasant feeling, but to end suffering associated with it, and that there's a reason why that happens. But it doesn't say you just hear it and then that's it, you're converted and you just do it. You memorize it. Well, you have to remember that those times they didn't have books and recordings and audio dharma and all that. So you had to memorize if you wanted to have a teaching close at hand in your mind. And then examining the meaning and gaining reflective acceptance. So you're supposed to actually think about, you can think, it's okay. You can actually think about the teachings and see if they seem to make sense. Do they resonate? Do they sound plausible? And sometimes, you know, it can take a little while actually before we get to that point. I'm thinking of Andrea Fella, who came to practice at a time when her life had kind of, she had a big disruption in her life, basically, and she was very angry about that. Her mind is an anger type, and so her response was to get angry that life had delivered her this blow, and angry at the people that were involved, and she was just on fire with her anger, and somebody gave her a Dharma book and said, here, you might want to read this. And she read it, and it had the instruction that said, if you feel a strong emotion, such as anger, you may want to be mindful of that and just observe the anger. And she read that, and she said, what? You know, I don't want to just observe my anger. I'm justifiably angry about this. She really felt righteously angry at this situation in her life. But she was just desperate enough, because anger is really a painful emotion, actually, to be all wrapped up in hate and irritation and just seething and it's not working and the world is against me. That's really an unpleasant place to be. And so she was suffering from that, you know, from that anger. And so she was just suffering enough to say, all right, nothing else has worked, I'll try it. And she tried it, and it was, of course, immediately relieving for her. Maybe I shouldn't say of course, but in her case, it was immediately relieving for her to do that. And she was sort of hooked on the Dharma at that point. So she, I mean, she didn't have to think about it too much, but she was kind of driven to try this out at sort of an introductory level. And then when it worked, this is just daily life practice. You know, she put notes on her computer, you know, about not being angry and catching herself and this and that. And so this was totally mostly off the cushion. And as soon as she saw the effectiveness of it, she was ready to sit. She was like, that's it. This is practice is for me. I want the rest of the instructions. She read the whole book. She sat down. And now she's a Dharma teacher, right? And so this was a big moment for her. But for her, it was a lot about the change of mind, the change of her heart and her attitude by actually checking the teachings for herself. And then what came was very much this zeal, which is the next step. Now, zeal isn't a word that people sometimes connect with. We think of zealots and we think, oh gosh, that sounds horrible. But the Buddha meant it in a positive sense. Like you really say, I'm ready to practice. You know, this is exciting to me. And so then all the other ones, applying will, scrutinizing, striving, that's all about, I'm not going to differentiate all those in this talk. It's about applying energy on the cushion and also in life, but you know, really doing the meditation. So what we learn, I think, is that there's a lot that goes on before you get to the cushion, and whether for you it's about cleaning up your behavior and getting a little more mindful in daily life, or if it's about changing your thinking such that you're able to accept the teachings and see how valuable they are. Somehow, you got to get to the point where it's time to sit on the cushion, and there's a lot that goes on before that. The Buddha didn't just teach meditation to monks. Very interesting. I'm going to give actually another example of this. There's also plenty of evidence. So let me back up and say that in the West, what we often do is we want to sit immediately. You know, we're like, just give me the end. just give me the final step. I'll just jump right to that. And we want to skip all this ethics and, you know, thinking, training and thinking and mind training and all this other stuff. So that's sometimes to our detriment, right? There are cases in the suttas. Apparently, we're not the only people who did this. There is a case in the suttas of a person who did that. And I want to tell that story. So it's Udana 4.1. There's a monk named Meghiya. And so he's a monk. He's ordained with the Buddha. And he's the Buddha's attendant at this time. So he's hanging out with the Buddha and serving him and so forth. But he's young and enthusiastic, kind of newly ordained and enthusiastic, and he sees this great mango grove, and he thinks, I'm going to go meditate there all day. This sounds great. So he goes to the Buddha, and he says, I want to go meditate in that mango grove. Am I done for the day? Can I go? And the Buddha says, I don't know if that's the right thing for you. And he says, no, I really want to go. And the Buddha says, well, it might not be the right thing for you. And he says, oh, please, I really want to go. So he says it a third time. And there's a tradition in Buddhism that three times is enough. Like if somebody says no three times, that's really it. It's no. And if they say no, no, and then yes on the third time, they might say yes on the third time. So in this case, the Buddha says yes on the third time. And he says, okay, do as you see fit. And so Meghiya goes and sits down in the mango grove. But he has a terrible time, actually. And his mind is overwhelmed by sensual thought, malevolent thought, and cruel thought. So all the wrong intentions, basically. And he's terrible, and he can't believe all this is happening, and he has all these sexual fantasies, and he wants to kill people, and all this stuff. And he comes back to the Buddha, and he says, it was horrible. I was this beautiful mango grove, but I couldn't meditate. And the Buddha says, Buddha's very kind, and he's compassionate. And he says, when mind deliverance is as yet immature, Meghiya, five things lead to its maturity. What five? Good companions, virtuous behavior, talk about renunciation and the Dharma, energy for practicing, and the development of wisdom about arising and passing. So we'll skip the last one because that's the actual, you know, that's meditation practice, but check out the first ones, Good Companions, Virtuous Behavior, Talk About the Dharma, and then Developing Energy for Practice. It's a condensed version of this gradual training where you clean up your behavior, you associate with the right people, you incorporate the Dharma, Dharma teachings into how you're speaking and thinking, and then you're ready to have energy for practice and sit down and observe arising and passing, which is what leads to wisdom. So a lot of this is clearly in the world practice. So right there, for an over-enthusiastic monk, you get the same teachings. So yeah, there's a lot. There's a lot for about this in the cushion and on the cushion and in the world, or on the cushion and off the cushion, even for monks. And that's, I think, more what we're imitating here in the West when we're trying to balance these two. The Buddha says, yeah, you got to have both. You got to do both. So I'm going to pause there because it's been a lot of talking. But this is kind of what the sutta, this is my lens on what the suttas say about this distinction between cushion and world, is that you do have to do both. They are different realms. And they relate to each other. You know, you have to, there's a lot that happens before you're supposed to sit on the cushion. I guess that's what I'll say. Not that we shouldn't sit on the cushion until, but, you know, just be aware that there's, you know, a lot that goes before that in the gradual training. Actually, I'll tell one more story and then I'll open it for comments, which is when Gil was in graduate school in Buddhist studies, he went to Stanford, and he met there somebody in the program who had come from Asia, I don't know where in Asia, and she was, you know, she was born in a Buddhist country and had been studying, and she was in this PhD program, and her family was Buddhist, and so she had all this background. And Gil said to her, oh, what do you do for your meditation practice? And she looked surprised and said, oh, I don't meditate. I'm still preparing to meditate. You know, I'm going through all the stuff that I think I need to do in order to be ready to really sit on the cushion. So, you know, of course, Gil had been meditating for years. He just jumped right in, and, you know. So that's just a difference. So for her, you know, it was like you have to do all this other stuff. Any comments on that, or questions, or examples?
I did have a question. You talked about listening. Did he ever talk about, like, that ability to just, like, quiet your ego enough to, like, give somebody else your presence?
Well, he does talk about ways to get rid of or to mitigate distracting thoughts. Thoughts of sensual desire, thoughts of cruelty, and thoughts of ill will, which are often thoughts about, you know, how I can get what I want and avoid what I don't want. And he also talks about, there's a lovely phrase where he says, one should listen to the Dharma as if one's life depended on it. And if you think about how you would listen if you thought what you were hearing, you know, your life depended on that, you wouldn't be thinking about, you know, how can I get this or how can I impress this person. So he was pretty clear about the way one should open to the Dharma. Yeah. But as far as, you know, compassionate listening or what, like, someone would learn in chaplaincy, I don't see a lot of that in the suttas so directly. I'd have to think about that more. Yeah.
I'm wondering how Western people... kind of the in-between between lay people and monastics, because it seems like there's a lot of Western practitioners, like you said, dedicated practitioners, that actually probably have studied as much and meditated as much as a lot of monks in Asia or more.
There are monks who don't meditate at all
in Asia.
Yeah.
Right. And so I'm wondering what your experience or... knowledge of that kind of in-between place of practitioners is in the West.
Boy, that's a great question, and it's something that's really of interest to me. I've thought about this for a while. I used to call this lay monasticism in my sort of internal vocabulary, And then I was told later that monastic really implies celibate, and I wasn't sure it should be that restrictive. I think a lot of, you know, there are lay people who are married who are very dedicated practitioners, and their whole life is about the Dharma. So I've now changed it to lay renunciate as one. But that doesn't necessarily mean living in a cheap way. I've come to think that the challenge for lay people living in this way is actually in the mind, and to find ways to renounce the mental habits that are so supported in society. Like, for example, in society, we're supported to try to get the best deal possible on things. You know, the consumer mentality of, you know, buy it cheap if you can, and, you know, etc. Or get as much as you can. There's various messages. Or get something that's going to give you good status in the world. And a lot of being a lay renunciate means finding ways not to buy into that, and still, and yet still buy things, because you have to buy your food and so forth. So a lot of it is developing internal strength to stand up to the messages of society. And then what you do with that, when one has that strength, what one does with it, is interesting. And that's a little bit what we'll talk about in the next section, is do you go out and do compassionate action and tell people, you know, how they're being deluded by the media or things like that? Or do you just live a quiet life and, you know,
Yeah, I'm just wondering if there's communities that kind of support that.
That's the next.
Like people that aren't going to be a monastic or live in a monastery, you know, full time.
I hear what you're asking about. Well, IMC is such a community. It's in some ways. It's not a residential one. And there's a lack of residential opportunities in the Vipassana tradition for people who want to be serious lay practitioners. Interestingly, IRC is one of the few. It's a retreat center, but people do live there. And, you know, you're serving the retreats. There's work that you're doing there. There's a point of being there. But it's pretty close to a Vipassana residential Dharma community. In Zen, there's the Zen Center in Tassajara and so forth. There are more options for lay people, because in the Zen tradition, there's less of a distinction between priest and lay, between monastic lay, than in the Theravada or Vipassana tradition. It's maintained a much more rigid distinction, I would say. And so then lay practitioners who are serious find themselves in this gray intermediate zone. And a lot of people are kind of on their own in that, and there's just starting to be the sense of, maybe there always has been a small sense of wanting to connect together. I would like to see more of that, and I have made little movements in that direction, but I think it's an area that can be a lot more developed, because there's lots and lots of interest, but no one's quite sure how. I'll just add one more area that's of interest, is I know there's a number of little movements on creating retirement communities.
Oh, really?
Lay teachers, or even serious lay practitioners who didn't ever become teachers, who are getting on in years and realizing, you know, it would be great to, you know, hang out and get six houses together with people, and then, you know, the ones who are healthier can take care of the ones who aren't as healthy, and just have some Sangha support. So I am very supportive of that. I would love to see those things come about. Okay, so let me shift then a little bit away from the suttas, you know, I think to really treat this topic of on the cushion and in the world, which is interesting to a lot of lay people in the West, I think what kept coming to mind is that the framework to use is that of wisdom and compassion, which is, these are two beautiful qualities of the mind. And they both need to be strengthened in order for the heart to be free, for sure. And each one, I think, has a natural domain. They're not separate. They're definitely not separate. But they're actually called the wings to awakening. even in the Theravada tradition, wisdom and compassion are called the wings to awakening. So you imagine that if you have one wing that's a lot stronger than the other, you'll probably just go around in circles, right? So they both have to be there together, and they sort of, you know, fly us to freedom. This view does fit nicely into Western culture, where it's easy for us to understand that distinction. But I want to say that I'm not only coming from a Westernized perspective. I'm not just imposing this. Actually, you know, this sense of wisdom and compassion being the main elements of practice is very common in Mahayana Buddhism that came after, or overlapped slightly, but then developed more fully outside and after Theravada Buddhism. Let me be careful with that. But it's a separate branch, developed much more in East Asia. So I'm not gonna turn this into a comparative Buddhist lecture, but just know that this lens of wisdom and compassion is not something that Kim is making up or that was invented at Spirit Rock. It's very much drawing from, as many people in this room know. So, you know, how do these work together? It is said that wisdom that develops in the mind and the heart through meditation is then expressed in the world as compassion. You know, that's kind of the natural way that it gets expressed. And I think if one were totally wise, like one is a completely awakened Buddha, then all of one's actions are compassionate, is kind of the extreme end of that. And for the rest of us that are kind of working on those wings, there's a sense that the amount of wisdom that we've gained can be expressed as a certain amount of compassion. And then maybe through that work in the world, we gain a little bit more wisdom in our sitting practice, and then we can do more compassion. And so they kind of feed on each other or support each other. And I want to try to make that a little bit explicit. So starting with the wisdom shifts our perspective in a general sense, right? So we start with our ordinary mind of thinking that we got to have this and that and get our pleasure and not have our displeasure, and that's the way we start out. And then we get through practice some shift where we start realizing, you know, this might not be what it's all about. Maybe there's something else. And so we start looking maybe more from the view of suffering and the end of suffering. And where is that coming from, and how am I contributing to that in my life and in other people's lives? So wisdom shifts our perspective, which then makes compassion more accessible. I'm speaking from my experience, is that once I start thinking more in terms of suffering and the end of suffering, then I'm starting to have access to compassion as a response to suffering, because I'm starting to see the suffering more clearly instead of just what I want, what I don't want, how angry I am about Donald Trump, whatever it is. I'm looking at the suffering. And then also wisdom has a way of, say in the form of mindfulness, developing strength in mindfulness, has a way of making the mind just more balanced in general and more equanimous and more open to seeing the Four Noble Truths and Three Marks of Existence and so forth. And so a mind like that is less reactive, right? A wise mind is in less of a reactive position, which again creates space for there to be a compassionate response. So this is how wisdom can help strengthen compassion. And there's a lovely quote from Christina Feldman who says, "As one becomes more selfless, which is to say more wise, there is less or no differentiation between their suffering and my suffering," right? So if there's less self, then there's less about me and you and how can I get my thing and so forth. Then there's much more openness to realizing that I care about your suffering too. You know, I don't only care about my suffering or my distress. And so there's a natural opening to more compassion as the wisdom helps our ego be less strong. So that's kind of that angle. And then with only a slight shift, I'll try to talk about the other direction. They end up sounding similar because they're so intertwined, but, you know, how could we sort of move from compassion toward wisdom? My sense of that is that compassion is what allows us to stay with a difficult situation long enough and openly enough for wisdom to arise. So suppose we want to develop wisdom, we wanted to understand suffering and its origin or its causes and its ending and its path and the path toward freedom. Well, how would one do that? Suppose you were sitting down and there was a lot of suffering and you couldn't be with it. You know, you sit down and there's physical pain and all you can do is leap up off the cushion, or you sit down and there's sadness and you just fall into it. You don't have the ability to see it. So compassion, if we can soften into that, and the compassion allows us to stay with the suffering a little bit longer. You know, if we have compassion that responds to suffering instead of a reactive response, then we can soften and just be with it and be able to say, oh, this is hard. What I'm sitting with is hard right now. That's a compassionate response. And that extra time that we get through being able to be with our suffering compassionately may allow us to see where it's being, you know, where it's arising or how it's arising or what conditions are supporting it. And then we could start to let go of them. So because of the compassion allowing us to stay with a situation, wisdom can come in and we can see the truth. So, and you know, very much it's about our own pain at the beginning. Through compassion for our own pain, we come to see the Four Noble Truths in meditation. We come to see how that comes about. And then also, through compassion for others, it's not only for ourselves, we can develop wisdom about the world. So I'll just offer a personal example, which is that I volunteer as a chaplain or as a spiritual caregiver at a hospital. And broadly speaking, my purpose is to bear witness to the suffering of others. There's nothing I can do for them medically. That's what the doctors and nurses are there for. But I can come in and not have an agenda and sit with them and ask if there's anything they want to talk about or just be with them, but somehow come and sit and show them that I can bear their suffering, or at least I can bear being in the presence of the situation that they're in. I'm not taking on their suffering, of course, and I don't feel it in the same way that they do. But just being there again and again, I'll talk about the personal angle first. I see again and again, yes, there is suffering in having a body. You know, I know that for my own body in terms of it gets hungry, it gets tired, I have to take care of it, I have to clean it, blah, blah, blah. But going into a hospital, you see that a lot more, right? Mm-hmm. Krista's a nurse. So, you know, you see again and again, this is what it's like to have a body. This is what can happen. And there's a lovely Christian phrase that says, you know, there but for the grace of God go I. You know, it's like, I'm not different from that person. If I had been in the car accident like them, that's the same thing that would have happened to this body. It's not any tougher. And so so there's some wisdom. We get sick, we get old, we die, we get injured. So there's a lot of education. If by having enough strength of compassion that I can sit in a hospital, there's a lot of gain in wisdom. I'm not even talking about the gain to the other person, which of course is profound also, the service that I can offer to them. But I'm speaking about our own practice at this moment. So from compassion can come wisdom. And of course, I don't want to leave it on the suffering side. I feel very privileged and honored that as a volunteer spiritual caregiver, I get to see some of the most amazing things in people who are in much worse situations than me. And yet, sometimes something is blooming forth in them and they're content and at ease and happy and joyful and somehow able to meet their situation. And I think, wow, could I do that in the situation that they're in? You know, not that it's all about me, but I'm, again, speaking from a personal practice perspective. And so I see people learning how to let go, how to be free in the midst of difficult situations. This is the third noble truth, the cessation of suffering. And I'm inspired that even in the hospital that can happen. So it's, again, though, if I didn't have the capacity to be with the suffering of others, couldn't bear witness to that. So there's a relation between the compassion and the wisdom and the developing of one and the other. So practically speaking, now we'll go to the balance of wisdom and compassion. They work together to help us navigate through the suffering of our own lives and the suffering of the world, suffering of other people, suffering of society, so that we can be skillful. We're not shutting down, denying it, but neither are we drowning in it. And I'm not saying that this is an easy thing. Many, many times we're going to find ourselves in a position where we realize we've built a wall, couldn't deal with that, or that we've fallen in, you know, and it's hard and horrible, and it's hard to find that balance sometimes of skillful behavior. But we do it, and practice, I think, calls us to engage both inwardly and outwardly. I've certainly found that. I want to mention, though, there's not only one path here. Gil likes to say, talk about the two responses we can have to suffering, and one of them is essentially called samvega, which means urgency or spiritual urgency. So feeling like we need to deepen our own practice. It's like, wow, you know, this is really difficult to be with, hard to be with, my own pain or the pain of the world. And so we sit, we go on retreat. You know, it's like time to go on a retreat. I need to deepen this. And that's a totally valid response. You may not turn and address that exact suffering, but instead deepen your own practice. And it's a beautiful response. And then another response can be compassion and going out in the world and serving people and educating people, doing social action or however one expresses that. So there's not only one way, nor should we think that one is better than the other, one is more compassionate than the other, that I need to imitate what that other person is doing. It's really our own thing. And there, you know, once there isn't so much difference between inner and outer, a lot of paths are possible. A lot of things open up. For a number of years in my own practice, I went on a lot of long retreats, up to 3 months at a time. I didn't think about this necessarily at the time, but looking back, it was totally a response to suffering. Mm-hmm. Suffering of my own mind, my own life. Yeah, so that was definitely a response to suffering. Or one can alternate, you know, you can go on retreats for a while and then go out in the world and then decide, no, I'm going back on retreat, etc. So I think I'll pause there and again ask, you know, how is this landing? Do you... You know, maybe just reflect to yourself, how is it that you respond to suffering? How is it more important for you right now to respond to suffering? Does it make you want to go sit on the cushion? Does it make you want to go out and be an activist? How is that unfolding for you right now? Or some other response?
Yeah, it's interesting for me to see, like, the two, because, like, it's interesting to see how these dynamics play out in society and, you know, constantly facing your own, you know, delusions in the media. And, like, that's a real way, like, to, you know, because you go on a retreat, you know, like, you have to face it because it's conditioning, but, you know, you're not having to deal with it actively. So mm-hmm. I think it takes a lot to actively, you know, be faced with these things that you habitually have seen and been wired to, you know, have these thoughts and these patterns and to be, have that wisdom. I think it's like very, very rewarding, even though it is very challenging.
Yeah. Yeah. The, in the world, watching ourselves behave and speak in certain ways that are conditioned is very, very humbling, I find. I mean, yeah, I can be as mindful as I can, but there's moments where I just, you know, feel that, and it's so powerful sometimes, that urge to behave in a habitual way. And really engaging with that and working with that and trying to be more skillful is an art form. And I don't, you know, I don't know that we ever are going to completely transcend our, probably not completely transcend our biological habits, maybe until our Ahanship. And even our cultural habits, I think, are really deep. We don't need to like push them away. You know, it's like, oh, I'm tired of being a Westerner. I'm going to go to India and, you know, put on a loincloth and, you know, be something else. People do that. And it can be educational to be something completely different. But in the end, I don't think we need to deny how we were born. But there might be a wending path before we get there. But, you know, it's some, you know, yeah, it's... And I'm not going to say one shouldn't go to India and put on a loincloth. Some people become enlightened doing that. It's interesting. And it's not easy because we're not wise, you know, because we're not enlightened. It's hard to choose which way to do it at any given moment. It's hard to know. Yeah.
It seems like the deeper you listen, you get closer to that kernel of what the response, where the response is coming from, of whether it is, you know, the suffering that you had, or whatever it is that's motivating you. Is it motivating you to sit or act? Mm-hmm. And the feedback loop there, I know for me, like now, it feels like sitting a little bit more than I had in years past seems to be what I'm compelled to do a little bit more. Whereas in years past, I didn't feel like there were still things that were compelling me to practice, but the practice had to be in the real world. Mm-hmm. Like it was almost avoiding the thing that was spurring me on to wisdom and compassion to just sit mm-hmm. with it. Instead,
you needed to go engage.
To engage in different ways. And so, I don't know. But some of that is sitting to listen to that stillness, that first response to the whatever the suffering, the input was to you. But some of it is just being still in the action that you're doing, still enough to know that's the right response.
No, that's beautifully said. And that at different times you might have a different need, and that internal listening is so important.
The funny thing is, sometimes I can't necessarily hear it or identify it. It's just, this leads to that, this leads to that, this leads to sitting, this leads to action. And, you know, it's almost it's the splitting the atom or splitting the now into microseconds or, nanoseconds. It's, then there's nothing there anymore when you get deeper. So there is no explanation, almost. So that confuses me when I get to that point.
That's... Just be with that.
Yeah, it's just let that go, too.
Let it be.
To be able to take in, like, to have this sort of mindful awareness, we need to cultivate an emptiness in our practice. Because I feel like if we're, like, always full, like you talked about the input stuff, that's taking up all that space, then we can't really see what's out there.
Well, I don't know if I would call that emptiness, but I think what you're pointing toward is that one thing we do in practice is we cultivate capacity or kind of breadth and strength of mind, and the mind has to somehow get bigger than what it's observing. Mm-hmm. And the very first act of mindfulness where we pull back and realize we're observing our breath or whatever it is, that's already the beginning of that. And then we have the capacity over time to hold more and more in the mind and not let it get overwhelmed and still have perspective over more and more domains of our life. That's kind of what comes to mind when you say that. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So the mind, like the sky, or like the ocean, eventually gets bigger than anything that would be in it.
Have you seen that in your practice? Mm-hmm.
Certainly there's been a cultivation of capacity. I'll give an example, which is there was a time, in fact, you know, early in my life, way before I started practicing, I was always sensitive to, at certain large family gatherings, there were some very noisy people or just people with a big presence. And it was always kind of stressful for me to be at these family gatherings where it got so loud and so many people sharing opinions. And when I first started practicing, that got even worse, actually, because I got more sensitive to speech and noise and these kinds of things. But I didn't ever do any deliberate exercises like how to build capacity in listening to other people or something like that. But I just kept practicing, and just over the years of practice, there came a time when I went to a family gathering and it didn't bother me at all. And it just went right through me like sound. And I realized, oh, you know, something has let go. I don't grab onto that as it goes by, or conversely, my mind has gotten bigger. It has enough spaciousness that this just isn't a big deal. And so something had developed, but I experienced it as something having been let go or freeing. So, yeah.
It seems like, from what you mentioned, that idea of emptiness enters into the picture too, is that you have let go and you no longer identify with being irritated by the noise.
I no longer think it's threatening to me or I have to do something with it. Yeah.
And instead there's space or there's emptiness. You just said that the sound goes right through you. Mm-hmm. There's nothing almost there, right? That can
react. So there would be the link to the emptiness.
Yeah.
Good. Well, it's nearly 9 o'clock. If there's one more comment, that's okay, or we could wind up. All right. Well, thank you, everyone.